The following lecture was delivered at the 18th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Miami, Florida, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Natalie Sanandaji now presents her lecture, I Was There, Witness to the Nova Music Festival Massacre.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, and welcome to a very special session on Simcha Amidst Hardship, Smiling Through the Tears. We are now in a time of war in Eretz Yisrael. And when we go to sleep, when we awake, in every continent, in every corner of the globe, our hearts are with Israel. Our minds are on the chatufim, on the hostages. And we ask, how is our brethren coping with the war, with the rockets, with the missiles, with the threat of annihilation? Today, JLI brings us an ambassador, a firsthand account from Israel. But this is not only a story of survival, this is so much more. This is the story of Natalie Sanandaji, a beautiful, warm-hearted Persian Jewish girl caught unawares in the epicenter of where it all happened. Yes, Natalie was at the Nova Music Festival on October 7th. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what it was like when you awoke at sunrise on October 7th at the Nova Music Festival?
So, as the daughter of an Israeli mother, I've been going to Israel almost every year my entire life. But it just so happens that I had never been in Israel at a time of war. And I was at the festival with a group of friends, and they were all Israeli, and I was the only American in the group. And I was the only one who had never experienced rockets being intercepted over my head. And when I woke up, something that was really important for me to get across to the audiences worldwide that I was speaking in front of, whether it was on the news or in interviews like this, I really wanted to like drive the point of how I was woken up. And I was woken up by one of the Israeli girls who at the time was on the dance floor and was awake when the first rockets were intercepted. And she knew that me and my other friends were sleeping. She came to wake us up, and she was so calm, and she kind of nudged us awake, and she was smiling. And she was like, hey guys, Boker Tov, good morning. I just wanted you guys to know a few rockets were intercepted overhead, but it's fine. It's normal for the area that we're in. We all knew that the party was happening near Gaza. And she was like, it's probably just going to be a few. It'll pass. The party's going to continue. Like, nothing to worry about. So I stayed fairly calm. You know, I looked to my Israeli friends and I saw how calm they were, and I figured, you know, it would be pointless to start panicking and freaking out. If she says it'll just be a few and this is a normal situation, then I believe her. So at first I was pretty calm.
And how did you realize that things were getting more serious?
I started counting the rockets. At first it was 3, then 5. Then it got to 10, 15, 20, and I saw my Israeli friends start to get nervous, maybe between 15 and 20. And when I saw them getting nervous, I obviously started to get nervous myself. And we started to realize this isn't just an ordinary situation. This isn't just, you know, Hamas trying to scare us a little bit. This is something more than that.
Well, you described the festival as being very welcoming and the very loving and everyone inclusive of each other. How did you see the difference between that and the lack of the sacredness of life coming from the terrorists? Like,
it's so sad, honestly. When I talk about all the lives that were lost at the festival, these were really beautiful souls. And you saw it in the way that they took care of each other, even in their last moments. I remember at certain points when they weren't shooting at us, we would stop or just walk a little slower to catch our breath. And I would see people taking care of each other and being there for people that they didn't even know, people that they didn't come with, because a lot of people lost their friends along the way and a lot of people were running on their own. And you saw the way that we took care of each other. And at the time, I didn't know a lot of the horrific things that happened while we were running. I was lucky enough to not see the murder in front of my eyes and to not hear the screams. But later, when I heard the testimonies, when I heard the stories on the news of all the horrific things that happened there, it just showed me how much they worship death and how much we worship life. And it's a bit scary, you know, when you hear the things that they did to the people at the festival. It's very hard to hear.
Very hard, very hard. Did you feel at any point, because we're all here, we're all children of survivors, grandchildren of survivors, did you see a special hashkacha pratit, which means divine providence, of God actually saving you by minutes or inches?
So it's, I had a hard time explaining to people, because a lot of people ask me, they're like, how did you know what direction to run to? How did you know what direction was the direction of safety? And the answer is that nobody knew. And I spoke at a vigil in Columbus Circle. This was like in the beginning of the war. And someone came up to me and he told me that he had seen a lot of my interviews. And he had seen that I was having trouble answering this question. And he told me that he had interviewed many Holocaust survivors in his life, and when they were asked in life and death situations how they knew what decision to make to save their life, they coined a term called a choiceless choice. And basically the meaning of a choiceless choice is, in those life and death situations, you don't have much time to try to understand what decision is the best decision, but you simply have to make a decision in that moment, whether it's turning left or turning right or hiding or continuing to run. And there were many decisions like that where we made a slightly different decision than other people we knew, and they ended up not making it out, and we did. And I really do believe that it's because someone was watching over me, because there were so many small decisions like that, and the odds of me making all the right decisions along the way are so slim. But then sometimes you start to ask yourself, you know, why me and why not them? Why wasn't someone watching over them? Why didn't they get that hashkacha? And we don't have those answers. And when you're given a gift, I guess people always say, don't ask why, just say thank you. So
you do have the gift of life. For example, when you were running, you went to you passed by those yellow bathrooms. And what happened after that?
Well, When I went to the yellow bathrooms, it was because we still didn't understand how great the threat was. At that point, we thought it was only rockets, which is a funny thing to say because rockets are still scary. But we were on our way to the cars from the festival grounds. That's when the festival security first told us to start evacuating. And in my mind, I thought, okay, it's rockets, but we have the Iron Dome and it's going to be okay. And our biggest fear was maybe scraps from the intercepted rockets hitting our cars. And we understood that it's over 3,000 people all trying to leave at the same time. We're probably going to be stuck in traffic. So I asked my friends, do you mind if I go use the bathrooms before we leave? And they're like, yeah, it's fine. We have time, no rush. We're going to be stuck in traffic anyway. Take your time. And not until 2 weeks after the festival took place, when I saw the video of the Hamas terrorists coming to those exact bathrooms, they came there maybe 10, 15 minutes after I was there. Not until then did I realize how much I was putting my life at risk just by going to the bathrooms. And it wasn't until after we started driving out and we heard the first gunshots that we realized that the threat was much larger than we thought, that it wasn't just rockets and that they were there on foot and they were chasing us. But there's so many examples. There's another example of about 2 hours into running, we passed by a group of our friends that were hiding in a ditch, and they saw us and they called us over and they told us to come hide with them. And I started crawling into the ditch, and then one of the friends that I came with started yelling at me and our other friends, and he said, if we hide in this ditch, we're sitting ducks. We'll have, if they find us, they're gonna shoot us on the spot. And he yelled at us and he told us our only option for survival is to continue running. Hiding is not an option. And unfortunately for our other friends, he was right.
Wow. Baruch Hashem. Did you wonder, I know a lot of people in my community ask, like Israelis, Ech kara kaze davar? How did such a thing happen? Where was the army? Did anyone explain it to you? Did you see the confusion?
We still don't have a lot of those answers, obviously, because the people of Israel and the government are so preoccupied with our main priority, which is bringing all of our hostages home. I think maybe once the war finally ends and we bring all of our hostages home, I think they will start looking into this more deeply. They have started looking into it a bit, and they know that some woman in the army that were in charge of watching the border, they told their commanders that there's people on the border that we need to watch out for this. And for some reason, they decided to leave it be and reconvene in the morning. Mm-hmm. And one of my main questions is, if you knew that there were people on the border, why wouldn't you cancel the party? Why wouldn't you tell this party that it couldn't take place? Mm-hmm. I don't have the answers to that. I don't know why. Wow. You know, that message didn't get across, because even if there's a slight risk, why would you take such a chance?
Right. Did any police people try to help you along the way?
So this was also about 2, maybe 3 hours into running, we ran into a police officer, and it was the first time that we saw any type of security that wasn't the security from the party. At this point, we hadn't seen any soldiers, and we were very confused as to why. A lot of people who tried to call the army or call the police to come help us, they told us, you guys are in a war zone, and we can't risk our soldiers and our police to come in, and you guys basically have to fend for yourselves and try to hide. And it felt a little bit as if we were korbanot. It was not an easy feeling alone. Mm. And we saw a police officer for the first time. And we asked him, we're like, where is everyone? Why aren't you guys here? Why aren't you protecting us? And he said that all of the people that he worked with in his like police office, that they were all killed by the Hamas terrorists. He was the only one who survived. And we asked him, well, can you call for backup? Can you call someone else on your walkie-talkie? And he said that the Hamas terrorists had taken over that local like police radio station, and that if he was to call for backup, he would give up our location to the terrorists. And he said the most I could do, all he had on him was a handgun, which wasn't even much to protect us with against the terrorists who had way more than that. And he said the best I can do is walk along your side. And as he was walking along with us, we heard the terrorists yelling on his walkie-talkie, and we understood that he was telling the truth, that he really couldn't call for backup. But it was really hard.
Very terrifying.
Once we got to Patish, it was after about 4 hours of running on our own. And Patish was the nearest town to get to safety at that point. It was a town where the terrorists hadn't gotten to yet. And most of the people who survived ended up getting to this town. And only about 3 hours after we got to the town was the first time that we saw any soldiers. It was 7 hours after the attack started.
Wow. So brave. Was there any point when heart beating with fear and terror in your eyes, you felt, this is the end, Shema Yisrael?
So I definitely said Shema Yisrael many, many times. But every person's body has a different natural reaction to such hard situations. And for me, as soon as the first rockets came, I completely disassociated to the point where I was really having an out-of-body experience. And it was very strange because I never understood what an out-of-body experience was. I understood that people would explain it as watching yourself from above, that it feels as if you're floating out of your body. And I really understood how that felt for the first time in my life. And I felt so disconnected from my body to the point where multiple times where they started shooting at us again, when they weren't shooting, we would walk slowly. And then when they would start shooting again, we would start running. And there were multiple times where everyone started running and I would stop and I wouldn't move. And I would just stare at everyone running past me. And it's because I didn't feel that I was in danger. I felt that I was floating above myself and only my body was in danger. But it felt as if I was disconnected from my body. So for me, it was really the opposite. I didn't cry once. I had to be, you know, shaken awake and told to like start running because I was so disconnected.
Mm. The Shem's way of saving you.
I think so. I think also after the incidents, I think I came out of this way less traumatized than a lot of other people because I was disassociated while it was happening. It was almost as if it was my way of protecting myself, you know, like kind of a defense mechanism.
Right.
And I think I came out of it way less traumatized than a lot of other people because it almost feels as if I didn't live it.
I see it in your eyes because we have people in our community, like a daughter of a friend of ours who was hiding in Urim and 28 hours, and she doesn't have the light in her eyes. Like she still has a lot of rage. How could such a thing happen?
Well, that's the reason why I started interviewing just 4 days after, because I realized I'm mentally okay. I can tell my story over and over again without re-traumatizing myself. And I felt that was a superpower I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to take advantage of that and speak on behalf of all of those who couldn't speak, all of those who were killed or taken hostage or too traumatized to speak out. There's so many survivors that even until today, it's been 10 months and they still can't talk about it without re-traumatizing themselves.
So you became a voice. So that's how you do Ahavat Yisrael, love for a fellow Jew. You're a voice for them. But tell us, if you will, how you experienced Ahavat Yisrael to you. How someone saved your life, actually.
So I actually touched a little bit on this yesterday, but I always felt so fortunate and so lucky to be born into the Jewish community and to be part of this nation. It always felt as if I had a safety net under me, that nothing would really ever go that wrong, that everything would always be okay because I had this safety net. And that was proven to me on that day because it's one of our fellow Jews who risked his own life to save mine. And he truly is an angel to the point where this person did one interview with me and since then turned down every single interview because he said, I didn't do this for the recognition. I didn't do this for an award. I didn't do this for an applause. I did this because this is who I am. And him and his son drove back and forth from Patish to the festival grounds for about 8 or 10 hours on that day and risked their lives over and over again, going back and forth. And they saved about 300 to 400 lives that day. And also his son was Shomer Shabbat, but he didn't think twice to go with his father. He got in his truck and he went to save as many lives as he could.
So just came to you. They came to you in a white pickup truck. Mm-hmm. So and similar.
Yeah, so when we saw the truck coming towards us, for all of us, like our automatic reaction was that these are terrorists. And a lot of people asked, you know, how we reacted. It was me and my three friends that I came with sitting under this small tree. And I think about maybe 5, 7 other people sitting with us. And I remember all of us, you know, kind of like half got up and contemplated running. And then we all automatically realized, we have nowhere to run to, you know, we're on foot, we're tired, we don't have guns. If this is a terrorist, they have a car, they have guns. And we all kind of just sat back down and accepted, you know, like, okay, like, this is our time, this is it. And I remember we're all just smiling and nodding at each other as if to say, you know, it was nice knowing you and goodbye. And as he got closer, we saw that there was a girl in his front seat and she was waving her festival wristbands so that we could see that she was one of us. And as soon as we saw that, he yelled at us. He told us to get in his truck. And I remember as he was driving us to Patish, we were told to walk towards Patish by the police officer. He said, if you continue walking in the direction of the sun, in that direction is the town of Patish. And so far, the terrorists haven't made it there. And as he drove us to Patish, I just remember I couldn't believe that I was actually in this person's truck. I couldn't believe that I was actually being saved. It was the first time in 4 hours where I felt like I could breathe a little bit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. But I've seen stories how even in the midst of the sheer panic, Natalie, you said, Am Yisrael Chai, that we will endure. How did you know? How did you get that strength?
I think I felt like it was our only option. And I remember one of my friends that I was running with, once we got to Patish, I asked him, I'm like, did you feel fear for your life? Like, were you scared that you were going to die? And he said, no, I had this strange feeling that we were being protected.
Mm.
And I felt the same way. And I'm very grateful to be here. And I'm very grateful to be able to be that voice for all of those who aren't with us. But unfortunately, there were many who didn't make it. And you do ask yourself, you know, why? But nobody has the answers to that. So
only Hashem knows. Yeah. But you, Natalie, Raquel, I just met you yesterday, and you're such a special person. And one of the stories that really makes me cry when I think about it is how you protected your mother. That's really a big mitzvah, kibud avaim, like honoring your parents. And I wonder how you did that, because everyone, all of us, especially Israelis, were like glued to the news. How did you protect her from knowing and from worrying?
So my mom, as an Israeli who lives outside of Israel, she's always glued to the Israeli news. I always tell people this story that there was a year where we moved to Florida for a year, and we sent all of our stuff from New York to Florida in a car that, like, this like company that takes your car across country. And before our stuff even arrived, when we got to our apartment, there was a guy waiting at the door. And I'm like, who's this guy? And she's like, oh, he's here to set up the Israeli TV. I'm like, Ima, we just got here. And she's like, well, I can't miss the Israeli news. I'm like, okay, I understand. So my mom is also an insomniac. And anytime she wakes up in the middle of the night, she usually wakes up once or twice. She'll always turn on the Israeli news just to see what's happening. And it was 8 a.m. Israel time. At this point, we were running for about half an hour. And my mom's calling me. And I knew that she was calling because she knew that I was at a party. And I'm like, I know that she saw the news. And that's why she's calling. And if I don't answer her, she's going to start freaking out. And my mom has multiple sclerosis. And this disease is also very much affected by stress.
Wow.
And if someone is too stressed out, it can really cause it to get much worse. And I didn't want to do that to her, especially because she's in New York. There's nothing she could do to protect me from New York. So I felt that I had to protect her. And she called exactly at a moment where there were no rockets being intercepted and there was no shooting. So it was fairly quiet and eerie. And everyone was just kind of walking in different directions and everyone was just confused. And I was like, okay, it's a perfect time to answer the phone. So I picked up the phone. I was like, hi, Ima, how are you? And she was like, I'm good, Natalie, how are you? And I'm like, I'm great. And she said, have you seen the news? I was like, yeah, like I saw something about rockets or something. And she was like, yeah, there was an attack at a party. Was it the party that you were at? And I was like, no, we were at a different party. We're actually on our way home right now. And she was like, okay, I just want to make sure that everything's okay. I was like, yeah, everything's fine. And then they started shooting again and people started screaming and running and I didn't want her to hear it. So I told her, I'm like, Ima, we're on the highway. I don't have good service. I'll call you when I get home.
Wow.
And I didn't call her. I didn't even call her when we got to Patish, because even at Patish, I was still nervous that the terrorists would come find us, because it took 3 hours after we got to Patish for any soldiers to arrive. I still didn't feel 100% safe and I still didn't want to worry her. So I didn't call her until I got back home to her brother's house in Netanya. And once I got home, I didn't want her to find out from anyone else that I was there. So I called her right away and I told her. But a lot of my friends, they called to check like where I was. And I told them, I'm in the middle of it, just so you know. But don't tell my mom.
Wow. I think that is... such a composure in such a young person. It's really remarkable. Now, Natalie is halochemet shalanu. She's our warrior. V'chol rachvei tevel, in every corner of the world, radiating strength, sharing her story. So Natalie, why do you feel it's important to hear testimony, to listen to?
I think for me, it's important for people to hear the testimonies. More so, for me, it was important for the non-Jews, I think, in the beginning, because so many people were dehumanizing what happened to the Jewish people. And it's because of the fact that it happened to the Jewish people that they felt comfortable dehumanizing it. And I wanted to give my testimony. I wanted to go out and I wanted people to see my face because I wanted them to see that I am human and that it could have been their sister or their friend or their mother. And I hope that I did have that effect on people. I hope that they felt more compassionate towards what happened after seeing me speak.
Right.
But that, in the beginning, was the most important reason for me to give my testimony. And then also for everyone here, I think about it all the time as an American Jew. If I wasn't there myself, how connected would I feel to what happened? And I think I would need to hear it from someone who was there firsthand to feel more connected to it. And that's why I come out and I speak. And every time I speak, I always thank the audience for listening because it's so important to us survivors that someone is there to listen. So thank you to all of you for coming to hear me speak.
So now your life really changed after October 7th, your job. Tell us about that.
So actually before October 7th, I was working in real estate in Brooklyn. And I always felt the need to put myself in an environment that was surrounded by Jews or surrounded by Israelis. Because when I first graduated college and I started working for regular companies, it was very hard for me to explain to them, you know, if I need to leave early for Shabbat or if I can't come because it's a holiday. And I got very tired of having to explain myself to people. And after a while, I realized I wanted to work and be surrounded by like-minded people. And I was working for in a real estate company run by a Jew, and most of the team was Israeli. And actually, my boss at the company, who is also a good friend of mine, it just so happens that his brother was one of the DJs at the festival and unfortunately did not make it out. So after the festival, he was very understanding of the fact that I wasn't going to come back to work because at the time I felt that my time was better spent giving my testimonies and speaking out as much as possible. And through speaking out, Jewish organization reached out to me, the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement. And originally they reached out to me to go to Washington and give my testimony to senators. And they set up a whole day for me to meet with many senators and tell my story. And it was a very powerful experience, especially because it was only about 2 weeks or a week and a half after the attacks. And after going to DC, the CEO reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to start working with them and to be able to continue, you know, speaking out and giving my testimony and speaking on the news or at events while also working for them. And it's been an incredible experience. And I got to where I am in a very unconventional way. And I'm now dedicating my life to fighting anti-Semitism. I'm so happy to be where I am, even though I got here in a very unconventional way. But my life now, my everyday life has so much more meaning to it.
So, so powerful. So what would you say, not just to the world, but what would your message be to Jewish kids who are confused, teenagers, youth, young adults, caught in high schools and colleges where everyone's accusing them of being white colonizers and oppressors? How would you give them strength?
So one thing, there's two sides to it. You know, there's the Jews who need that strength and they are fighting for Israel and the Jewish people. And then there's the ones who are a bit confused and don't realize how important Israel is to their existence, even though that they're living outside of Israel. I think it's unfortunate to see how many Jews there are who don't realize that Israel existing is the reason why they can't exist outside of Israel. It's as if Israel is their Iron Dome. And it's very important for me to get that point across to a lot of the American Jews who don't seem to understand that. And then for those who are having a hard time on college campuses, as someone who survived the attacks, I always tell people, I don't know how college students are surviving today. I don't know how I would survive being on a campus every day where I feel that I'm being attacked, you know, emotionally. And sometimes physically, unfortunately, they're being attacked. And I would give them strength by telling them that we're not going to stop fighting, not just for Israel, but for them as well. And they're, thankfully, I have seen a lot of change. You know, there are a lot of college presidents that have resigned,
exactly,
that should have been fired, but ended up resigning. And we're going to continue fighting for them. You know, we're going to continue fighting for their safety because they deserve to feel safe. This is their home at the end of the day. You know, Israel's our home as well, but this is our home also.
So, so true. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen how the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, would talk about Jewish souls. Like each one was a diamond. When he would give out dollars on Sunday, he would say, do you ever get tired of counting diamonds? And I watched a clip of how you went. There was a Nova exhibition in Manhattan with all the rubble of the cars and the shoes, and even some festival goers found their things. And there was a wall of faces, like 364 souls. And when you were looking at them, you said, I see light. Can you elaborate?
I think you had to, you know, really be there and to meet those souls. When I said I see light, it's because I don't want them to die in vain. You know, I want the fact that they were taken from us to, I want to be able to turn that into light. I want to be able to turn that into positivity. I want to be able to turn that into hope for the Jewish people. And it's hard to say to, you know, let's try to see a silver lining in something that was so horrific. But if there is a silver lining, it's the fact that I've seen the Jewish nation come together and really put aside their differences and really be there for each other in a way that I haven't seen in a very long time. And in a sense, I think that's them not dying in vain. That's them giving their light back to us, which I think is really beautiful. It's something beautiful to see both here in the States and in Israel.
That we have empathy for one another and we see past differences and we see each other as souls. Simply souls. Another thing that the Rebbe said was, I remember as a child listening to the talks he would give, and he would say, "Eine asher Hashem alokecha me reishis hashana ve'ad acharis hashana," that the eyes of God are God is on the land of Israel from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And you've said so proudly, and newspapers have put it on headlines, "I feel safer in Israel, even in a time of war, than anywhere else."
That was one of my favorite things that happened, was the confusion that people felt by my statement. And I was happy that they were confused about it because I wanted them to ask me about it. I wanted to explain to them and to explain to all the audiences that were watching why I felt safer as a Jew in the land of Israel, even at a time of war, than I felt anywhere else in the world. And the answer is because in Israel, when I'm walking down the street, I know that I'm surrounded by those who are with me and those who think the same as me and those who love me and those who will protect me. And it's unfortunate that New York, the place that I called home my entire life, I no longer felt that safety. I remember the first time I ever experienced real like anti-Semitism was when I went to visit my family friends in France. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, it's so unfortunate that they have their French identity and their Jewish identity, but they don't feel that the two can go together. They don't feel that they can be outwardly proud Jews in their homeland. And I remember thinking, I'm so lucky that I'm from New York. I'm so lucky that I'm from a place where I can feel that safety and I can feel proud. And it's unfortunate that today I don't feel that same safety. But I think it made me realize more than ever that Israel is my home. It's my real home, and it always was, and it always will be. And even with everything happening, you know, there's so many Jews making Aliyah, because even at a time of war, even when there's constant threats of attacks from Iran, thousands and thousands, especially from France, but thousands and thousands of Jews are constantly making Aliyah. And it just goes to show how safe and how at home we feel in our land.
So, so true. I just met a woman the other day who was visiting Nashville from France, and she said, I live in a good neighborhood right near the Louvre, and every week there's protests and against, and like Zionists go home, and she would go out on her porch, and one of the protesters told her, like, you know, laughed at her for crying, and she said to her husband, we are making Aliyah.
I mean, yeah, one of the major rabbis in France, he told all the Jews, he's like, we don't have a future here. You all need to get out, and a lot of them have.
Wow. So I know, Natalie, that your Jewish pride is always been strong, and you say you always light candles, but mitzvot are a little different for you after October 7th?
I think they hold a little more meaning for me now. Number one, because I know that I was protected and that I was saved, and I feel so fortunate. But also they hold more meaning for me now because I do them with the hostages in mind. I do them in hopes that they will bring the hostages home. And, you know, we had an incredible hostage who spoke last night, who got out, and she said that she felt those prayers. She felt them protecting her. And today and every day, I do them now with them in mind, hoping that they feel them and hoping that it brings them home sooner.
Wow. You said you began to say even a little Tehillim. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I always say it with them in mind. I say it also to say thank you for the gift that I was given, the gift of my own life, but I mostly say it with them in mind, hoping that they'll be brought home soon.
Wow. Wow. So, Am Yisrael Chai, hearing such a story, it's just the emunah you have, that you were left with the emunah and the resilience and the bravery. It's incredible.
Thank you.
You're really a gift to the Jewish people. At this time, we want to, you would like to? Yeah, Natalie said she's open if anyone in the audience has questions about her story, about her mission, about what she's gone through, about her Jewish pride.
Thank you so much for being here. You are, as I shared as you were talking, I said, I have no worry about our future. And I really mean it. Can you share a little bit about if you're working on anything and what you perceive might be some next steps for you? Because I think a lot of us who are building the future understand that we get to build it because of people like you, and I'm really interested to hear what you're thinking about it.
So through my work, I've been working on kind of bringing both of my identities together, which is my identity of being an Iranian Jew, and then also my identity of being the daughter of an Israeli mother and being a survivor of the Nova Festival. And for the first time in my life, with everything happening in Israel right now, we've seen a lot of support from the Iranian people and how much they're trying to prove to the world and show the world that they are not their government and that they are with us the way that a lot of the Israeli people and a lot of the Jewish people were with them during their Woman Life Freedom Movement. And it's kind of the first time in my life where I feel both of my identities coming together as one, and I'm trying to kind of create a coalition of bringing Iranians from all backgrounds together against the government, because they understand more than anyone that we have the same enemy, because they know that Hamas is a proxy of their government, and that's something that for some reason, a lot of Americans in the United States, non-Jewish ones, don't seem to understand. And that's kind of a point I'm trying to drive home to a lot of these ignorant people that don't understand that. They don't understand that it's the same enemy, but the Iranian people do. And I'm trying to make more connections in that sense and bring more people together so that we can come together against this one common enemy. Because when we're together in numbers, we're greater.
Beautiful. Very true. Any other?
You're a very good speaker, and you convey a very positive message very clearly, and I thank you for that, because you know it's very easy to get lost in the negativity. I wanted to know, were there other Americans there? Have you kept in touch with people from the festival, survivors from the festival? And now that you're really a public figure, have they gotten in touch with you? Have they reached out to you?
So there were some other Americans, one of them being Hirsch Goldberg, who unfortunately is still being held in Gaza. And there were a number of others. I would say the majority were Israeli. Since the festival, I have met so many other survivors who have become some of my closest friends today. And we really are there for each other. And for me, it was really important to meet other survivors and to make those connections, because nobody else can really understand what you went through. Even if they try to understand, they'll never know what it was like to be there and to run for hours from the Hamas terrorists. And through the organization that I'm working with today, the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement, I've also got to meet other survivors. And there's this kind of duality in my life now of the fact that I'm one of the survivors, but I'm also working with an organization that's helping a lot of survivors. So I speak to a lot of survivors. I go back to Israel a lot, and we work on a lot of projects to help those who still aren't doing okay. And I'm kind of on both sides. I'm the one helping them, and then I'm also one of them, which I think makes them feel more comfortable with me as well. And it's been an incredible experience to do that for other survivors who aren't doing as well as I am today.
Well, thank you for your leadership. Thank you for your bravery. Thank you for your resilience. And we bless you. We say those who sow in tears will reap in joy. We should only have bracha.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.